Welcome to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Driven to Business is a business forum program that focuses on success principles in business. And now, it's time for Driven to Business.
Good morning and welcome to this week's edition of Driven to Business. I'm your host, Eddie Mayfield. Glad you're here. As a reminder, we're streaming live on biz1190.com. Today's program will be podcast on eddiemayfield.com and on iTunes. By the way, you can go to iTunes and subscribe to our podcast, so you ought to do that. Great guest today. Our guest today is Mike Siegel. Mike is the Director of Data and Research for Landmark Communications. He also happens to be the chair of the fourth congressional district here in Georgia. And on top of that, he was a 17-year college professor teaching history. Mike, welcome to Driven to Business.
Thank you very much, sir.
Mike, with all the talk about the recent election here, everybody's kind of all in a tizzy about it. You did a great job of really better than the national polling organizations of polling exactly how the race here in Atlanta, in Georgia, I should say, was going to come out with you. Let's talk about those races just a bit. First, about the governor's race. Talk to us about just your views of that race.
Well, we polled the governor a few days before the final election at 51%, Carter at 45%, and Hunt at 3%, with almost 2% undecided. In the last week, the undecideds usually go with whoever has the momentum or they decide not to vote. If you add the 2% to the 51, you get 53%, and that's what Deal received in his race. Carter received 45. That's what I pulled him out. Hunt received 2.4%. I had him at 3. And so that's about as close as you can get in the final poll.
It really is. And in the Senate race, you actually most of the national media was saying there's going to be a runoff. You were one of the people that said there was not going to be, and you turned out correct. Why do you think several polls showed Carter leading Deal early on?
Right after the primary, the Republicans, as you remember, had a very heated primary and a very heated runoff. But right after the primary, there were still some hard feelings from the race, especially for Senate. And so it took a little bit of time to smooth over these hard feelings and unite the Republican vote behind the nominee. However, these swing voters, independent voters, undecided Republicans, were natural Republicans if they were treated properly by Deal and Perdue. In the last 2 months, the nominees made their pitch, and they picked up these undecided votes. The Democrats, in comparison, the Democrat base was not as divided as the Republicans. So they were unified earlier, and by all appearances, neither increased nor decreased very much. Plus, what a lot of the pollsters did not get right in the beginning was that they didn't have the weighting correctly, and they didn't anticipate some of the changes in demographics. The black vote was going to be up a few percentage points from 2012 to 2010. We had the black percentage at about 30%. The female percentage, almost every general election, is about 54, 55%. Some of the polls that were discredited varied widely in how they weighted, and some of them actually changed their weighting over time, but I did not.
That's where the smart guys like you actually do come into play, is knowing those things that some of us don't know. I want to talk more about you about that in a minute, but you know, for Governor Deal, by the way, this is not strictly a political program. We have listeners, most of whom are business people, and one of the reasons I am interested in this kind of thing, number one, just as a resident of Georgia, of course, it's interesting to all of us how the election came out here. Regardless of whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, I think the inner workings of it are of interest to you as to how that works. But on top of that, if you sort of substitute the term likely voters with likely customers, you might get a little bit of where I sort of come from on this, is the idea that the same thought process in a way goes into landing a customer that goes into landing a voter and in predicting where you might find customers and where you might not. Governor Deal, I've met him a few times. I don't know him well, but I have met him a few times. He's a warm, decent person, but he's not, and I don't mean this as a criticism of him at all. He's a very honest, humble guy. Mm-hmm. He's not an effusive, charismatic type person. Do you, just in your opinion, does that hurt him politically or not?
I'm going to praise him a little more than you do. I think he's very charismatic. I think he's a very good, decent guy, as you agree. I also think that he tries to appeal to the overall voter in Georgia, the overall resident.
Right.
And not everybody in Georgia lives in Atlanta. Not everybody in Georgia lives in North Fulton or Cobb or Gwinnett. And so he creates the correct mix of being folksy enough for Hall County, where he's from, able to relate on agricultural issues in South Georgia. But by the same token, he also is very much a tied into the pro-growth, pro-economic development, pro-jobs program that he's brought in the last 4 years. And so I think that he's a good mix of all of Georgia. He had a few distractions during his campaign, obviously, but he's been around the bend for quite a while. So as long as none of those distractions were insurmountable.
You know, one of the things that I did see him in action on that I really admire about him, and again, the race is over now. He's a governor, so if you voted for him or not, this is not. We're not campaigning now. He's rather famously said this is his last campaign.
Yeah.
So he's not running for anything else. You know, he appeared at an event at our church, a Steve Green concert at our church. He came there, and he actually spoke briefly when he was there. And after it was over, he went with his by entourage. I mean, his wife and his driver slash guard.
Mm-hmm.
They went to a Wendy's very near the church there, mm-hmm. and stopped and went in to have dinner. Well, a bunch of our other church folks were in there, and they talked about how the governor came in, went and stood in line. The people behind the counter did not know he was governor.
Yeah,
he gives his order. They even fouled up his order a little bit.
Yeah,
he was very gracious about it, very kind. And as people began to realize who he was, they went up to him again, talking to him. Very gracious, very humble guy. Who then, I think he got his meal to go, and he said goodbye to everybody. He went back out in the car. Got back in his limousine. I don't know. I know that's an anecdotal story, but to me, I think that has a lot to say with the guy's character, who he is. He doesn't put on airs, and I think I do think on a one-on-one personal level, that's very appealing to people. What I meant by not charismatic is he's not a firebrand speechmaker or anything.
No.
He doesn't get crowds to stand up and cheer and scream or anything. But he's a very decent guy, and even people that are of the opposite party that did not support him will tell you that about him.
I really like his wife, too.
Yes.
Thanks, Sam. She's a very,
yes.
very good person.
Ms. Deal is awesome. If you had been advising the governor during his last campaign, for all I know you were, is there something you might have advised him to do differently than he did?
Well, first, he won, so,
right.
Hindsight's 40.
Exactly. Yeah. Can't argue with success.
So,
really.
So whether he took even if he had taken my advice, it would only have been worse.
Right.
If I was advising him to do a better job, to meet as many of the GOP leaders as he could, going down to the lowest level as time would allow. I don't think Deal nor Perdue spoke with all the district chairmen, and I don't think that they met one-on-one with very many county chairmen. If it's something that could be done, and this is something that could have been done in January, and it would have been made it much easier to unify the party after the runoff. When you have a business and you're trying to find out what's going on, you try to talk to the people at the lowest level you can. And sometimes some are worth more than others, but if there's a problem, that's where you go. If you're not selling enough stuff, then you talk to the salespeople.
Exactly. You know, this race here, both the Senate and the governor's race, attracted a lot of outside attention, as you well know. I mean, and a lot of outside money came in on both sides,
right,
to support it. I just wondering, in your opinion, do the outside influences shape a race very much, or do the candidates running here locally pretty much just take their money and ignore them? Do you have yet?
A little bit of both. Money is very important. What's the old quote that there's not a big difference between a lot of money and a little money, but there's a big difference between having a little money and no money?
Right.
And so money's important. But in the end of the day, it's only worth something if it could be translated into votes. If you don't have the votes, if you don't have 50 plus one, you're going to lose. And so the Democrats did not get a lot of bang for their buck. They spent a lot of money and didn't get a lot of votes for what they were spending. The Republicans did a pretty good job. There's some spending at certain levels is more efficient than others, but you really don't know that until after the election. And sometimes there's intangibles that are very hard to measure. My personal view is that outside money tends to make the campaigns more professional, but also makes them less efficient. because you're not always listening to the people on the ground who said, well, you should have talked about this or talked about that. And people up in New York or Washington don't always know what it takes to carry Gilmer County or Union County or DeKalb County or whatever.
I really just thought of this question while you were talking. I know that for me, and I don't know if I'm a typical voter or not. I don't have any idea. But for me, I mean, I knew who I was going to vote for mm-hmm. as soon as the primary was over. I already knew that. I was going to vote Republican. I knew that. And it didn't really matter what anybody's ad. They could have spent $100 million on ads or 10 cents. Neither of them would have affected my vote in the least. Am I unusual? Who are these ads directed at, I guess is the question.
Well, the less informed voter.
Okay.
The people who make up their mind the last month. The people who split their ticket, and there's not that many. The people who the decision is whether to vote or not to vote.
Right.
The Republicans ran a much better ground game than they did before, and it was geared toward getting people who sometimes vote and sometimes don't, but if they do vote, they were going to vote Republican. The Democrats have always done a better job of that. This is the first time the Republicans really put a lot of effort into it, and it was one of those intangible things that was hard to measure. But I'm going to praise the people who did do the ground game this time because they did a very good job. A month ago, I would have said, well, I don't know. But now, obviously, they won and did well. So I got to praise them for that. But who are the ads targeting? Certain kinds of ads are trying to gin up support among people who don't always who may vote in presidential years, but not always non-presidential
right,
years. Other types of ads are going toward people who are who decide at the last minute. And those people are not like you and me.
Well, you know, I get very annoyed. Yeah. We all do. You know, you hear negative ads are spoken with a great disdain. But mm-hmm. I sort of look at it as a marketing kind of person and a person with a background in sales. Is if those were not effective, they wouldn't be running them. So obviously, the negative ads do have some effect. I do think by the time they're all over, we're all really good and sick of them in about 30 seconds.
Oh, yeah. But if I can run a negative ad against my opponent's base and get his base to not turn out, then that's good for me.
So it's to discourage.
Discourage them. And they're going to do that to my base.
Too. Right. That's a great point because I would hear people say, well, did you know that? And they would name off either candidate.
Yeah.
You know that Governor Deal was involved in this. I said, where'd you get the information? Oh, that was his opponent's ad. Well, you can't really believe that. That's not the way it works. You're listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. We're here every Saturday morning at 11 o'clock right here on Atlanta's Business Radio, Biz 1190. Back in a minute. Welcome back to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. We're glad you're here. Let me tell you, first of all, that Biz 1190, Atlanta's Business Radio, has an iTunes app. Go to the iTunes store, download that. It's awesome. You can listen to our program and all the other programming here on Biz 1190 AM. We're talking with Mike Siegel. Mike is, I always think of him as sort of a polling guru. Mike is with Landmark Communications, a very interesting guy to talk to about this recent political race here. In Georgia, Mike sort of has a ground-level view of that, sort of a pollster's view of that. I find it very interesting. Mike, let's talk for a minute about the race between – we talk about the governor's race for a minute. Let's talk about the race between Michelle Nunn and David Perdue. And this is another race that you called almost perfectly. So give us a quick overview of that race.
Both candidates ran as outsiders, but in real life, both of them were longtime insiders.
Right.
Nunn was raised in the Democratic establishment, just like Carter was. Perdue served on a number of national boards, local boards, and when he was a business leader, he was an important donor to both parties. So the image was somewhat different than the reality. Both Nunn and Perdue hired outside national consultants to do most of their work, so their campaigns were very professional but also very predictable. Nunn went negative, claiming to be more of an outsider than Perdue and the other Republicans. She did not emphasize any real issues. Brought up her father when people asked what kind of a Democrat she was. The problem was that very few people today voting were old enough to have voted for Sam Nunn. And this is especially true of the Democrat base, which is younger than the average voter. So she led, but only as long as the Republicans did not define her as an Obama supporter. Perdue only had to unify the Republican base to win. No one who voted for Obama was going to vote for him, and no one who voted for Romney was going to vote for her. as all he had to do was convince the base to unify behind him. And he did that by defining none as a vote for Harry Reid and Obama. Once that was finished, it was only a question of whether he would win with a runoff or not.
He's another example, I think, of a fairly bruising primary.
And he
came out pretty bloody. I knew nothing, almost nothing about him until after the primary, to be honest about it. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I'd thought that before about Michelle Nunn, which, I mean, if you're a political junkie and follower, you certainly know Sam Nunn and all that. But my kids, for instance, adult kids who vote, don't know anything about Sam Nunn. They wouldn't know who that was if you asked them. And I do think that name recognition only goes so far. That may help in money raising and fundraising and things like that. But I don't know that it carries, as you had mentioned, particularly with a Democratic base of who is even younger than the Republican base. They have no idea who that was, who Sam Nunn was, or what he stood for, or anything else.
Well, look at Carter. The last time Jimmy Carter was on the ballot was 1980.
Right.
And if you take 18 years before that, the 62, that means everyone born after 62 had never voted for Jimmy Carter.
Right.
And Nunn was I think it was late 80s when he last time he ran.
Well, you did, again, call this race very well. We were all told, if you and I'm probably a complete nerd on this, but I was really interested in watching their election returns. I was switching between several channels to sort of, and on the internet all at the same time to sort of see who was saying what about the race. But almost all of the national polling people said there was going to be a runoff, and it was just stated as a matter of fact there would be a runoff, and you know, we wouldn't know till December who the senator from Georgia was. You didn't say that.
No.
How did they get it wrong?
Well, there was a lot of bad polls this year, and a lot of people are going to point fingers. Early in the campaign, national pollsters didn't get the science right because they weren't familiar with Georgia demographics. But we always try, and some even didn't get the art right. National polls had the gender mix at 50-50, and that was never the case. There was a poll that actually had more men voting than women. That was never the case. It's always been 54-55% female. The percentage of African Americans was wrong in a lot of the early polls. Some had the African American percentage at 24% or 25%, and it hadn't been that way in decades. We always polled at about 29-30% African American, right. And that was in line with the trend for the last 4 years. And so, one of the things that happened that was interesting was the national pollsters started correcting their weighting, and so it was no longer apples to apples; it was apples to oranges. And when they corrected their weighting, the polls became closer, and they says, "Oh my goodness, this is going to be a close election." But since we never changed our weighting, and we saw the Republicans were doing better, we could see that the momentum was going in our direction.
Right.
And so so you really couldn't use the other pollsters necessarily till the very end to see exactly what was going on. And near the very end, the last week or two, everybody had the Republicans up, but the measure was whether it was going to be enough. And as I said before, we had about 2% or so undecided. And that almost always goes whichever side has the momentum. And our polls showed that the last 2 weeks or so, the Republicans were up, and so they were going to get the momentum.
Mike, I've always wanted to ask this of a pollster, and if this is part of the pollster code, you can't tell me, and you've sworn to secrecy, I'll understand. But I used to be suspicious about some polls, that the polls were trying to drive a result. Like, you'd hear polls early on, and we talked about negative ads discouraging a turnout. When you hear a poll that says, well, this guy doesn't have a snowball's chance and you know where, well, then as a voter, you think, well, what's the point? I mean,
some unnamed competitors do that sometimes.
Okay.
But one of the things that we do a lot of polling, and sometimes our polling is like of a state house seat or a state senate seat or something like that. And what we're looking for is who are the undecideds? What's their demographic breakup? What issues may motivate people to move them one direction or the other. And so we have to be very precise and very accurate in how we do things. And we do a lot of polls that we don't release or release publicly that will just between us and a particular campaign.
Right.
We were not employed by any of the statewide candidates at any level this year.
From what you observed in both of the races this time, or the entire election, I guess I should say here, for those that would like to see Georgia, Republicans who would like to see Georgia remain a red state, and I guess if you are a Democrat and you'd like to see it be a blue state, you can just take this advice at the opposite side of it.
Yep.
But what's your takeaway advice from this election?
The Georgia Republican Party is very diverse, but we don't always market ourselves that way. We don't market our diversity. Deal did a great deal to benefit the African-American community. He worked to fix the education problems in DeKalb and Clayton County. He pushed charter schools, which was very important in the urban areas of Georgia. He pushed some judicial reform that was very popular, that was supported by both parties. And what we need to do is publicize a lot of that again. The other thing is that the party apparatus needs to do more in ethnic communities. This year I did an auto call in Vietnamese, and we've done radio ads in Korean, and we've done direct mail in different languages. And that's a start, and we need to do more of that. The worst political picture that I've ever seen was a picture of Bob Dole winning the New Hampshire primary when he was the youngest person in the picture, and he wanted the national newspapers to have a picture of him with his World War II vets. And the problem with that was that there were nobody that was female, nobody that was non-white, nobody that was under 70. And so what he was basically saying was that we're the party of old white guys, and we need to be the exact opposite of that in order to win.
I think just as in business, you have to be careful about not what you intend to say in a message, but what your message actually says about you. I think in business terms, if you call up and you get one of these infernal machines that mm-hmm. nobody likes talking to, well, you've given a message about your business, whether you mean to or not. You've given a message about that. Or when if you promise somebody you're going to have a service technician out there tomorrow morning, and tomorrow morning comes and goes and nobody shows up, and then you call them about noon, they call about noon, and you say, oh, yeah, we can't get here today, that'll be tomorrow. Well, you just sent a message about your business.
Oh, yeah.
Whether you mean to or not. And that's a very good point. I think that you do say there. I am seeing, I follow people on Twitter now. There are a lot, and the Republican Party is still, I think it'd be fair to say, the majority of the Republican Party is white, but it is changing. It is changing. And I think the Republican Party is making efforts without diluting their message or their morals or their core principles to reach out to others. And I think that does have a lot to do with us here in this great state. You're listening to Eddie Mayfield. This is Driven to Business, and we're talking with Mike Siegel with Landmark Communications, and more to come. Hang around. Welcome back to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. We're talking with Mike Siegel with Landmark Communications. We're mainly discussing the recent election here in Georgia, sort of the inside, I don't want to say the dirty politics side of it. I don't mean to say that. We're not, but sort of the dirty gears of it, of how these things actually work, how the pollsters do figure this out. Mike did a great job of predicting this race, and I think it's very much to his credit. Mike, you're with a company called Landmark Communications. Tell us what you guys do.
Landmark was established in the early 90s, and we're a full-service political marketing firm. We do everything from direct mail, polling, social media, phone and walk lists, strategic campaign planning, radio and TV ad placements, and quite a number of other things as well. Through the years, we've worked on a wide range of different races. In the last 2 years, I've worked with Landmark since 2006, and in the last 2 years, I've worked with candidates for mayor, judge, solicitor, county commissioner, Georgia General Assembly, school board, and Congress.
Is there, I'm accustomed to being around some ad agencies and not political, although some of them do dabble over into that a little bit. Do you see that somewhere where like a commercial ad agency that's running, selling cars will suddenly begin selling politics? Now, I guess you can make a great point here for why you should use you and not them if you're going to do that.
Well, there are some companies that will dabble in politics every once in a while, and maybe they're good at radio ads or good at TV ads, but they're not always very good at the strategic planning or the strategic placement of some of their ads. And that is, to some extent, that's where we come in. Somebody else might understand color a lot better than we do, but we know what type of ad needs to run, what type of stations it needs to be on, what demographic makeup of the people we're trying to target, what the zip codes were trying to hit, which zip codes are more important than others for a particular race, and things of that nature. And oftentimes people who are not involved in politics they won't understand that.
Right.
Maybe they understand cars. Maybe they understand electronics. But politics is a little different when you open the hood and look under the hood.
You know, suppose I come to you and say, "Hey, Mike, I want to run for the U.S. Senate seat the next time in case Johnny Isaacson doesn't run or something." Aside from telling me that I don't have a snowball's chance, and you know where, well, but assuming I did have some kind of political background, what do I do between now and then to start getting ready for that?
Meet as many people as you can who can introduce you to other people
right.
who are worth meeting. One of the things, I'll give you sort of the example, we did a congressional race in the first district, and one of the things I did very early in his race was I made a list of every elected official in the first district. And I said, if I make you a list, it'd take me forever to do it, but if I can make you a list of every mayor, every county commissioner, every coroner, regardless of party, will you go and make and give them a call? And the campaign said, sure. And so he had several months to go out and talk to the mayor of towns that only had 1,000 people in them.
Right.
But by the time the race heated up, everybody knew who he was. And he was a sitting state senator. And so people in his part of the district already knew who he was. But there were certain counties where he had never had any real impact before the race started. And they had one county in particular that had a very low population. We ended up winning it in both the primary and the runoff. And it was only because he went out there and actually met the people that were important. And it was a small county, and there probably was 5-10 people in the whole county who could have introduced him to everybody else and secured his him winning that county.
You know, in many ways, that even in this modern technological age that we live in, that's the same advice someone would have given somebody 50 years ago, isn't it?
Yeah. And you have three things. You have money, you have time, and you have votes. And everything has to translate into votes at the end. And time is the most valuable thing because near the end of the campaign, it runs out. But if you do proper planning, then you can get a lot of things done beforehand before your opponent gets a chance to go out and hit the hustings.
I hadn't thought of asking you this, but I'll just ask you now. And if you don't know, you can just take a wild guess, and we'll believe it's the truth. Man, what you tell us, we'll probably believe it. But, you know. If you're going to run for, let's just say, a U.S. Congress seat here in any district around here, what kind of money are you going to spend to do that?
It'd be hard to say. If you don't raise over $100,000, people won't take you seriously.
Right.
There are some people who say, "Well, I'll support you and I'll write you a check, but you have to raise X amount of money before I write you the check."
Right.
And those are the big donors who always...
They just want to know you're a serious candidate.
They want to know you're serious.
Right.
Now, in the primary, maybe 200,000, 300,000 will open the door. 500 is what you need.
Wow.
For a heated general election, 1 million, easy.
Right.
And some districts are more expensive than others. Some states are more expensive than others.
I think the Senate race cost a lot more than that.
It was brutal. And a lot of those people spent time raising money that they otherwise should have been or could have used it meeting the people, and that was tough. I mean, because again, time is the most valuable thing you have, and it runs real thin near the end.
Politics aside, I mentioned this earlier, but I find the whole concept of what you do as far as identifying voters, identifying what resonates with those voters, finding out who. You have no chance at all of getting their vote, so you're just kind of wasting your time to go there to get that. And then devise ways of how to get your message to them. And so from I know you're mostly into politics, but from a business angle, you got any thoughts on that?
Look, do a good survey of the people already buy your product.
Right.
Find out what makes them happy, and then turn it over and try to market people that are very similar to them with the message that that resonates with the people that you already use. There's a oil change place that I'm very loyal to, and I always go there, and I've been going there for quite a while. And I go there because they're quick, convenient, and reasonably low priced. And I could go, if I was a marketer and I had their advertising budget, I'd always say what you need to do is to get a list of everybody owns a car within a mile and market those things which you do well to them. and go after the people that live that would view you as convenient, and go to them.
You know, one of the things you're saying there is something I've said on the program a lot, and it's not original with me. A lot of people say it. Is that marketing really is information? Information is marketing. You know, even in politics, mm-hmm. Mike, I think a lot of it. If people don't know, if I'm running for, you know, you name it, county commissioner, and no one knows my name, mm-hmm. well, they're not going to vote for me when they go in there. And I think that's why you see signs everywhere. Mm-hmm. A lot of us do go into the polling booth. You know, we're all, like a lot of us, I'm a fairly informed voter, I think. I knew all the big names. You always get in there, though, and there's guys running for some office. I never heard any of these people. So you tend to say, I've heard of that guy.
Make a guess what the most powerful grassroots groups are. They're the PTAs.
Is that right?
And there's a fellow who's a state rep in my area. And his first election, he won. First election, he went out. And he was a principal of an elementary school, very tied in to all the schools in the area. He went out to all the PTAs. He convinced the PTAs that they needed somebody who knew about education. And he's perfect for them, and that he was going to take care of the PTAs. And he did. And the PTAs were all usually middle-aged women who had kids, who had their time in the middle of the day free, and were willing to work hard and go door to door. And he beat a friend of mine who ran in a different race against him, not because he had more money, but because they had more volunteers. And the PTA people were willing to knock door to door to say, "Well, I know this guy, and this guy's a good guy." And that was enough to get his message out.
You know, it really does, because in a lot of these small, and I'm not being demeaning of any of the mm-hmm. state, I don't mean that, mm-hmm. but those are not names that roll off our tongues all that much, because we don't hear much about them. And so if you've got, we talk a lot in here, but the best advertising possible is word of mouth, even mm-hmm. in this technological age where we're all walking around with all these gizmos and TV, radio, and all this stuff. The most effective advertising there is for a business is word of mouth. It trumps everything. And I think what you just talked about in politics right there is really an example of that. That's just from the fact that somebody comes to the door and says, "I'm a member of the PTA over here. I know this guy. He's a good guy." I'm thinking, I like that school. I like the PTA. Yeah. If she says he's a good guy, well, okay, he's a good guy. And I don't know anything about these other people, so I vote for that guy.
And if he had, say, 100 volunteers and each of them could guarantee 10 votes,
right,
then that's 1,000 votes. And that's a lot of votes in a race like that.
You're exactly right. It certainly is. Mike, how did you get interested in the business you're in here? Because you were teaching history. So how did you get in this business?
Well, I'm an old Boy Scouter. At least that's how I describe myself. And when I was younger, I wanted to understand how the world works. And so I got a master's in history from Georgia Southern. And I taught college history for 17 years. And that sort of taught me how things happened in the past. I wanted to understand how things work or why things are the way they were. So I studied geography, and I actually taught college geography for a number of years. But I also wanted to make a difference in the community. And so at one level or another, I've worked in politics since the late 80s. The first time I was in any sort of leadership position was in 92. And we did the Paul Coverdale runoff in Chatham County, and I headed that up for the Chatham County Party.
Oh, what a great guy he was.
He was. He was a very good guy. And we actually lost Chatham County by 1,000 votes. I tell people that. And Chatham County was very Democrat then, and is very Democrat now. So it was sort of a big deal. And so I'm interested in politics because you get to meet a lot of good people. There's a lot of good people in politics. There's a lot of bad people in politics. And you can't really tell the difference until you meet them. And you can't really tell the difference on their TV ads. If you believe all the ads, then you think they're all stinkers. The reality is there's some really good people out there, and you have to sort of meet them and interact with them and form your own opinion. And I've had the honor of meeting a lot of really good people. There's a couple of people that are sort of questionable, but most of them are pretty good. And the other thing you find is that a lot of people are very personable at the lower level. And so sometimes you can create some friendships and relationships that you might not necessarily have otherwise.
While you were talking, I was thinking, I just off the top of my head, I used to have a sales territory in West Texas, and mm-hmm. When I lived in Houston, and I was out there, it used to be the town. I can't remember the name of the town, but I remember the sign. Somebody, and this was a real street town sign you drove into, said, "Welcome to," whatever the name of the town was, said, "home of 400 happy people and a few old grouches. That's what the sign said.
and sometimes it's when you work with some of these people, you know who to complain to.
Well,
and I've had a few instances where I've called people up where I had a real issue, and oftentimes they've been able to solve it.
And you know, and that's an important thing. Just as a citizen dealing with politicians, if the only time they hear from you is when you're mad about something, that's true of the business too with anybody.
Yeah.
If you only speak to the waiter when you got a complaint, but if you're nice. If you have a relationship already, then when you have a complaint, it actually gets listened to a little better, I think. We're talking with Mike Siegel with Landmark Communications. I'm Eddie Mayfield. You're with Driven to Business. One more segment coming up. Stick around. Welcome back to the final segment of today's Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. As a reminder, we're here every Saturday morning at 11 o'clock here on Atlanta's Business Radio, Biz 1190, talking with Mike Siegel with Landmark Communications. I always like to get a guy like Mike on who knows a lot of stuff I don't know, and so that's always fascinating. And it's not hard to find people that know things I don't know. Let me correct that right quick. That's not really much of a task. But in the area of politics and polling and so forth, Mike is really sharp at this, and I appreciate, Mike, you being on here today. Mike, if what I read is correct, about half of the eligible voters in the United States do not vote. And I sort of have two trains of thought about this, I guess. I've thought about this before. First of all, uninformed and apathetic people voting would probably do little to help the process. But on the other hand, folks that don't vote would seem like a huge untapped pool for somebody to go in and convince to vote. And I guess that's part of what you're talking about in your polling of likely voters and all this. Give us your thoughts about this.
Uninformed people, or the people who control uninformed people, unfortunately run the world. These people are frustrated easily. They refuse to get involved unless they have a direct short-term benefit. They have little faith in the system. The powers that be in both parties encourage this kind of apathy in order to reduce their influence of these people. Why do you ask? Well, uninformed people have very low expectations of economic or societal change. And so these people, that if they think that everything's going to be bad, and then they don't vote, and then everything's bad, then they're going to think, well, this is the same as it ever was.
Yeah, I told you so.
Exactly. But if you want to fight this type of apathy, and I do, and other people do.
You know, it's like the guy's got the tombstone that says, I told you I was sick. You know,
yeah, exactly. But if you want to fight this guy, this apathy, to educate these people, you have to. One of the things that you learn in politics is that politics is a very long process. And the length of the process is a good thing. I'm not a big fan of certain people in Congress who vote against my interests, but they represent a certain faction of the population.
Right.
And they're legitimate voices for people who disagree with me. And by the same token, there are people who agree with me on everything who do a very good job of articulating what I care about. And it's this sort of mix of the two that finds a solution that works, that is essentially politics. Compromise is not always a bad idea. What I mean by that is that if you have two sides that hate each other publicly, that doesn't necessarily mean they hate each other when they get inside the room.
Right, right.
Because oftentimes what they'll do, if they're smart, is they'll say, well, these are things that I want. Which of those things are acceptable to your side? And so I have 10 things on my agenda, and you have 10 things, and three of them we both agree. We'll pass those three things, and we'll argue about the other stuff later. And Obama doesn't do a good job about that, but some of the better presidents we've had in the past have been masters of that.
I think that comes into that earlier famous saying that you know, one in a democratic process, one should never watch laws and sausages being made, because it can be a little messy in there. Let me ask you just a straight polling question, and this has a little bit of business overtones to it. We have the same problem in business that I think some of you pollsters do. It's reaching out to people that we think might be potential customers, but with this day and age, it's very hard sometimes to get in touch with people. Even with all the plethora of electronics we have now, people have also developed pretty good filters about how to filter out people that they don't want to talk to. You know, none of my adult children, for instance, have a landline phone. Mm-hmm. And so you're never going to poll them over a landline phone. They don't have one. So how will pollsters like you meet that challenge? How do you do that?
Well, as long as there are people that will answer a survey that are demographically or randomized, demographically similar to right. people who don't have a landline, then I can get close to what I need. If I call 40,000 or more randomized numbers and 10% of them or one out of 40 answer, that's still 1,000 numbers. And so I might not be able to get you, but I can get one of your neighbors.
Right.
And if your neighbor feels the same way that you do on things, then that it can, there could be a legitimate survey. Now, the problem comes when you have certain demographic groups that are less likely to answer the phone than others. Certain demographic groups that are more likely to be cell phone only, or they're on cell phones, but they're not on smartphones. And you have to do redouble your efforts through landlines and other things to try to reach enough of those people to be scientifically valid. One of the things that's going on now is people are trying to use new methods to get surveys done. Do it on Facebook, do it online, do it on emails. There was a firm that pitched me that was said, well, we have X number of thousand people on our list, and we send them a survey, and they fill it out, and we pay them money in order to fill out the survey and send the survey in.
That seems like that would be a filtering mechanism right there of
exactly.
that demographic.
Yeah. Exactly. Now if I was selling McDonald's and I said, well, I want you to send a question, filter questions, have you ever eaten at McDonald's, and I can probably get enough people.
Right.
But if there's certain demographic groups that I know are going to vote, but are very hard to reach, then I have to sort of redouble my efforts, and maybe I'll call extra numbers in that area. Maybe I'll do. You cannot use an auto call to call cell phone, but I can use live calling.
Right.
And so it's far more expensive, but I can buy cell phone numbers, and I have a live calling operation trying to reach those people that I not normally be able to reach. That's expensive.
But it is unquestionably a challenge mm-hmm. because of you're facing something different than previous generations of pollsters had yeah. to face in that regard. I know this is a bit cynical, mm-hmm. but I've often wondered about who these much vaunted and much discussed undecided people are right at the end of a campaign who's truly – how could you know anything – or have any principles or any, for whichever way, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, how could you tend to lean toward either one of those? How could you be so blasé as to be undecided at the end of an intense campaign like what we just had here in Georgia?
My fat fingers. Hey, no, I'm just kidding. We had undecideds about 2-3%.
Right.
And some of the people actually said on an earlier question that they'd already voted. But they were undecided on that race. And so go figure.
That just reinforces my view of undecided people.
Exactly. But what you have is that historically, people are undecided in the last week. They either don't vote or they go with the momentum because they're going to vote for whoever they think is going to win. And a significant number of people have already decided a month before or 2 weeks before. A third of people early vote. And so by the time we took the last poll, about a third of the 900,000 people had already voted, and so you're talking about really reducing the number of undecided to about 2-3%.
Right.
And again, they're going to go with they're either not going to vote or they're going to go with whatever the momentum is.
Your call on that is really what really made you a superstar here in the polling. You guys called that almost perfectly where the undecided was going to go.
Well, we did that 2 years ago. We were very good. 4 years ago, we were the only ones that said deal was going to be handled in the runoff.
Ah.
And that was, and everybody else, and I even knew people that were polling at the same time, but we were we made the call. We called the Marshall Scott race down in the 8th district, and that was a lot of fun because we called it for the Republican, and then everybody said horrible things about me. And then a Democrat pollster did a poll that showed the same thing we did, and then we did a second poll that said the same thing. And with three polls all basically saying the same thing, it was pretty obvious that that we were going to pick up that seat.
You cannot argue with success. In about a minute, and this is an unfair question to ask yeah. you in about a minute, but we talked about a wave election nationally,
mm-hmm.
and you talked about undecided as going with the, I forgot the term you used, sort of go momentum. Did that play a big role here in Georgia? You think the Republican sort of wave through the United States?
It did, but there are certain things that you can't measure before it hits.
Right.
And so most people knew there was going to be a wave after a certain point, the depth of it, the breadth of it, and even today we don't know exactly the racial makeup of everybody that voted. The Secretary of State has not released that yet, but just because you know it's coming doesn't necessarily mean you know the full effect of it.
But there is for certain. You think there is a bit of it swings a national mood, particularly in statewide elections, and you do think that does.
Yeah, and we won the 12th district. If you remember, that finally knocked off Barrow.
Yeah,
and we pulled that district twice right before the election, and said that Allen was going to win. And I think if there was not a wave, we might not have won that election.
Good deal. Mike, you've been a great guest. Thank you for being here. You've been listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. We're here every week at 11 o'clock, and I'll see you next week.
You've been listening to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Visit next Saturday at 11 a.m. on Biz 1190 for more Driven to Business. To learn more about Driven to Business, visit eddiemayfield.com or call 770-448-4644.